Right after I was asked to do this, I was given a tape, and I listened, of Michael's, and I listened. And I want to tell y'all, you've heard of the Arkansas Traveler. He ain't got nothing on her. She is the Georgia Roadrunner. I'm telling you. She really is. But I listened to this tape two or three times, and I got to feeling like we was real good friends about that fourth time I listened to it. You know, I'm a little slow, but I thought we was getting to be real good friends. And a few weeks later, I was at the Atlanta Roundup, and the lady speaking on Friday night, Polly, was Michael's sponsor. And I heard her mention that a lot of her ladies had drove and come in to see her, and she mentioned Polly's name. And I went and asked Charles, who was our taper and a good friend. He knew Michael, and I asked him, I said, is that my Michael? Y'all see how sick this is? She don't even know I exist. You know, my Michael. And he said yes, and he went and brought her to me and introduced her, and we got to talk a little bit. And I tell y'all, she loves the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She does. She gives back to this program. She is gone just about every weekend. And if you call her Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, you have to wait till 10 so she's home from the meeting. She really loves this. So please help me welcome my Michael and y'all's Michael.
All right, my name is Michael Manning Earl, and I'm a female alcoholic. And Judy, that was such a nice introduction. Thank you. And she's just been a gift. She's stayed in contact with me this whole time, and that's always nice. Some conferences call you a year in advance, and you don't hear from them until it's time to get on the plane. And so it's nice when you pay a lot of attention to us. And I want to thank Jerry and the committee for inviting me. And the gift that we received, I don't know if we all got the same gift, but it was a beautiful handmade picture. It was gorgeous. Thank you so much. I'm really excited about this lineup of speakers. I know a lot of them, and they're really dear to me. I have been impacted by these other speakers in my sobriety, and I really encourage all of you to come to the Al-Anon speaker at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. He has an awesome story. I hate for anyone to miss it. He has a story equal to any alcoholic story I've ever heard. So, and his wife is speaking Sunday morning, so you need to come. But okay, are there any newcomers here with less than 30 days? All right, that's great. Thank you. I'm just going to share with you what...
you have to talk direct in this mic. It won't pick it up if you don't.
Do I need to start all over?
No.
Hope I don't have to start all over. What I was told when I first came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is I was told that you needed four things to get started. The first thing you needed was to get a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was told that you needed to get a sponsor. And hopefully your sponsor had a sponsor and was grounded in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You needed to get a home group. And very importantly, you needed to get a sobriety date. Sobriety dates are very helpful when you want to get sober. But I encourage anyone who's having trouble getting a sobriety date to please just keep coming back. I was at a meeting somewhere, and this one person was circulating a flyer, and she was trying to get the meeting to approve a change in the preamble where they didn't welcome anybody who didn't have 24 hours of sobriety. And I was just absolutely appalled, because if a drunk can't go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's sad for the people that are sitting there in the rooms. Nothing's better than working with a wet alcoholic, as far as I'm concerned. I heard Peggy Martin share not too long ago that Alcoholics Anonymous is going back to the original days. Treatment centers are on their way out, and I've already experienced that, but treatment centers are on their way out, and we're going to, you know, we've been handed 30-day sober people on silver platters, and it's not going to be that way in the future. We're going to have to be sobering these people up ourselves, and it's a real exciting period that we're coming into. I mean, nothing's better than having a drunk in your car that vomits on your shoes. I mean, it's exciting. I know it doesn't sound like it, and you're going, ooh, but it really is, and nothing makes you appreciate your sobriety, you know, as when you see a wet alcoholic. And so it's just a great thing that we're coming to. So 12-step calls, I think maybe they ought to start having workshops on how to do a 12-step call like they used to do. Anyway, I'm going to share with you, bring you up to date. A lot of people have heard my story, and I'll bring you up to date for the ones that haven't heard what I've been through recently. This last year has been one of my best years, but it's been one of my hardest years. I've had major, major changes this last year. First of all, I had a major career change, and I was working in the musical theater industry. I was business manager. I had a very impressive job, and I left that industry and went to work as administrator of a residential care facility, which is a retirement home, but they have different levels of care. So it was a total job change. And then I met this man. I was speaking at a conference in South Carolina, and I met this man that I just fell madly in love with. And the only problem is I lived in California and he lived in Georgia. Then I got fired from that job that I had just, I had been there a year and I got fired. And it's a whole lot of things that happened. For one thing, you taught me here in Alcoholics Anonymous that honesty is very important, and I was required to lie to the state about a few things, and I wasn't willing to do that. And as a result, several things happened, and I was fired. And I just cannot tell you how devastating it was. That wasn't part of my story. I never planned that in my AA talks to tell people that I, with 16 years of sobriety, I was fired. What am I going to stand up here and say, if you want what I have, do what I do, and you too can be fired with 16 years of sobriety? It was just, I did not feel worthy of standing up at a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. But when these things happen, you just don't see the whole picture. And one thing it did, it allowed me to spend more time with the man I'd already fallen deeply in love with. And he ended up proposing to me. We got married and I moved to Georgia. And it was a fairy tale romance. It was a fairy tale marriage. This is so corny, I'm embarrassed to share this with you. We even live on a street called Sir Lancelot in Camelot Court. It's just too corny. And I wish I could tell you that we lived happily ever after. But unfortunately, I went into menopause. And all I can tell you is menopause, what an order. My husband just can't go through with it. And with that, I'd like to introduce you to my husband. Ted, would you please stand up? He's just the most wonderful, wonderful man. It took God 16 years to get me ready for a marriage like this, but it was a real turbulent 6 months. I thought I was having a nervous breakdown. I thought I just wasn't adjusting to moving to Georgia. I was having panic attacks. And you hear about hot flashes and you hear about night sweats, and that's the least, you know, of the things that I went through. And I just did not have a clue what was happening to me. And I was so thankful when I found out it was physical and it wasn't mental. And I will tell you, I am on estrogen therapy. And I have to admit, estrogen is definitely a mood-altering chemical. And I don't think anybody here would want to take it away from us, at least not my husband. But thank goodness we both had enough time in this program, and we were very grounded that we just worked our steps all the harder. And there was a point where I really did want to leave. I really wanted to go back to California and call it quits. And I couldn't understand it because I love him. He's everything I thought he was. He's just the most wonderful man. But I just wanted to go back. And somebody reminded me that I made this commitment as a sober woman. You know, I have a lot of years of sobriety, and I made this commitment as a sober woman, and I couldn't quit. And I'm not saying that women that make these commitments and they're being abused and that kind of stuff should stay in it. I don't agree with that, but I was not being abused. He was just kind and loving, and he was wonderful. But I just wanted to leave, and thank God, because of the years I had, I stayed. And the last few months have been wonderful. They've just absolutely wonderful. And I didn't quit 5 minutes before the miracle. And I kept my commitment. And we're coming up on a year in 2 months. In 2 weeks, we're going to be married a year. And I'm so thankful. Anyway, when I crawled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous over 16 years ago, I had a formal ninth grade education. I didn't know how to work. I lived on welfare. I was reduced to prostitution, and I was a thief. And all of that was before I took that first drink at the age of 25. And when I broke down and took that drink, I immediately went downhill. So as you can see, there's nothing in my background that's prepared me for speaking except for the fact that I am an alcoholic. And I try to speak from the heart, and I've always heard that Alcoholics Anonymous is the language of the heart, where the heart speaks and the heart listens. And I really want to welcome any newcomers, and I like newcomers to know that the absolute highest you get in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober. It is not a speaker. And I'm not an authority on AA. I'm just up here sharing my personal experience, strength, and hope. And the things I say from the podium are the things that had a profound effect on my personal sobriety. And I'd like to welcome those of you who are not so new but are having difficulty with this program. I saw a sign in an AA club that always gave me a lot of hope. And that sign says that you're not a failure unless you quit trying. And I believe that's true. So please, whatever you do, just keep coming back. But I was told early on in this program that this program is not for spectators. This is a program of action, and those actions are the 12 steps as laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Bob, one of our co-founders, said if you boil those 12 steps into two words, those two words would be love and service. And before he said that, he said, I want to emphasize the simplicity of this program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes that are interesting to the scientific mind but have little to do with our actual AA work. And I see a lot of things drifting in and out of this program today. They might not be Freudian, but they're just as useless. And what they do is they just complicate this very simple program. Now, in the big book, under Doctor's Opinion, it tells me that many types of alcoholics do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. So I'm here tonight to tell you that I'm one of those alcoholics. In fact, so is my mom. We both tried to recover from this disease through the psychiatric effort. Different times, but we went to the same psychiatrist. Of course, the result was nil, but the good news is that today, that very same psychiatrist is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, my mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through the religious effort. Different times in different congregations, but the result was the same, and believe it or not, today that very same minister that counseled me is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to joke around and say I think we drove these two men to drink. But the truth is, and this is the truth, my mom slept with the psychiatrist and I slept with the minister. That's why I'm usually invited to be the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. One thing I know for sure is that psychiatrist, that minister, and myself are perfect examples that AA works when other things fail. A little bit about my background. First of all, I'm Irish, German, and Cherokee, and I'm illegitimate. And being born out of wedlock today is just not a big deal, but when I was a little girl growing up, it was. And my childhood's pretty appalling, so in my mom's defense, I want to tell you a little bit about her childhood, because as bad as mine was, my mom's was worse. And this program gave me the ability to have a very loving relationship with my mom, even though she couldn't quit drinking. And I lost my mom over 3 years ago. She died of lung cancer. And I had the opportunity to practice love and service at home. We took my sister and I took my mom home. We had hospice come in, and we took care of her, and she actually died at home, and she actually died with a little bit of dignity. And I had the ability to get in bed with my mom, hold her all night, and just love her unconditionally. And I had to watch this woman drink on top of morphine up until the day she could no longer swallow. And it's probably one of the hardest things that I've ever done. But one thing I learned from this whole experience is that my whole life growing up, I was so focused on the things I hated about my mom, the things I didn't want to be like, that I missed all of her wonderful qualities. My mom had a lot of wonderful qualities, and I really miss her a lot today. But my mom came from an alcoholic background. And when she was 13, her mother was murdered in a drunken brawl. A drunk slit my grandmother's throat. So that left my mom out on the streets at the age of 13 trying to raise herself. At the age of 14, she had her first baby, which she gave up for adoption. And then she had me, and she did everything in her power to keep me. She later met this man, got married, had three boys, and we all moved to California. That marriage soon ended in divorce, and my stepdad moved back to Colorado. So that left my mom out in California trying to raise four little kids. And we were raised on welfare. We were raised in extreme poverty, always having lights, gas, telephones turned off, always being evicted, even sleeping in cars. And then I had to deal with my mom's alcoholism, I had to deal with her prostitution, I had to deal with her suicide attempts. When I was 12, my mom got pregnant again, and this time she sent my three younger brothers to live with their real dad in Colorado. Now, my three brothers were my very best friends. When you're sleeping in cars, you're always being evicted, you don't have an opportunity to make friends. So my brothers were my friends. So I feel like at the age of 12, I already had all these feelings that I later brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And those feelings were of low self-worth, low self-esteem, not equal to and just not good enough. And that was a direct result of all that poverty. The drunken psychiatrist pointed out to me that I had issues of abandonment. You know, I never knew my real dad. My stepdad went away. My three brothers went away. My mom's always trying to kill herself, and because of some other childhood experiences, I would say I'm a fear-based person. I have always been afraid of people, places, and things. And the two very important things I learned when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, first of all, I learned that feelings are not facts. All those things I used to think about myself were not the truth, and best of all, I learned how to walk through fear. And I learned that every time I walk through fear, I'm actually exercising faith. And this last 4 years, I've walked through one of my biggest fears, and it's getting on airplanes. It took me 12 and a half years of sobriety to finally get on an airplane. And I found out I'm not even afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing. My sponsor told me I had to be clear on what my fear was when I was asking God to remove it. But you know, I used to think I didn't work a very good program because, I'm very spiritual, I've had lots of spiritual experiences, but I would hear people in these meetings say, if you have fear, you don't have faith. If you have fear, you don't have faith. So I used to think something was wrong with me and something was wrong with the way I worked this program. And one day somebody took me over to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they took me to the fourth step inventory where it talks about fear, the fear inventory. And I've done a fear inventory, and I've read it lots of times, but I just needed someone to point it out to me. And they pointed out the sentence to me that says, all men of faith have courage. And then this person pointed out to me that you don't need courage unless you're afraid. And he assured me that you can have fear and faith at the same time. The point is just learning how to walk through it. And I was assured that every time I walked through it, I was exercising faith. So anyway, at the age of 13, my mom did have this baby. And I had to learn how to be a mom. And I didn't even know how to be a kid, but my mom's alcoholism took her out of the home. She was never ever around. And I had full responsibility of this little baby. And this little baby is sleeping in a dresser drawer, and I eventually had to potty train her and bottle break her. I'm failing in school because I can't get to school because of this responsibility. Now, after doing my inventory, I found out the truth was I hated school anyway. Now, when I went to school, I was either an object of pity around my peers, or I was teased about the way I dressed and teased about my hair. And so specifically to get out of my home life at the age of 15, I got married. And the man I married was 18. He lived in the neighborhood. He came from a similar background. And I have such a colorful past that I like to brag about this. I want everyone here to know when I got married at the age of 15, I was not pregnant. At the age of 15, I had high morals and high values. I really did. I had these two TV shows I used to watch, and most meetings now, people are too young to even know what these shows are, but it was Donna Reed and Father Knows Best. And these were family programs, and because of these programs, I had these high morals and high values. My whole life growing up, all I knew is when I grew up, I didn't want to be an alcoholic like my mom, and I didn't want a prostitute like my mom. So when I got married at the age of 15, I had this wild idea that I was Miss Donna Reed, marrying Mr. Father Knows Best, and unfortunately it didn't turn out that way. And I believe the man I married was an alcoholic. And one indication, his name was Johnny Walker. I didn't have a clue then. But I want to share a story with you about that sister of mine, the one that slept in the dresser drawer. Because when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to blame my alcoholism on my mom's alcoholism. And I blamed the way I turned out on the way I was raised. And after I got sober in this program, I took a good look at that sister of mine because she came from the very same background. In fact, I would say her childhood was worse than mine because my mom's disease had progressed. And she was literally forced to move out of the house at the age of 16. So she quit school and she moved out. But what she did is she took that high school equivalency test, and she had to take it 3 times until she finally passed it. With this test under her belt, under a special youth program, she went to work for the city of Long Beach. At the age of 26, she retired from the city of Long Beach. She took her 10 years retirement pay. She bought her own business. She later married the head traffic engineer for the city of Long Beach. And 4 years ago, at the age of 30, my sister was awarded Woman Entrepreneur of the Year. Now, even today, sometimes I still don't get it. You know, same mom, same background, but different reactions. And the difference is my sister is not an alcoholic. My sister is not bodily and mentally different from her fellows. My sister reacts to life situations differently than I do. So today I get to accept responsibility. I can no longer blame people, places, and things. Yes, I am an alcoholic, and I do have a disease, but today I have a solution. And for me, part of my solution is being accountable for my actions, my past actions, and my present actions. So anyway, at the age of 15, I got married. At the age of 17, I did have a baby. At the age of 18, I had to get out of this marriage because this man took me through a whole new phase of alcoholism I never experienced with my mom, and it's called physical abuse. And he never abused me unless he was drinking, but he abused me to the point of cutting me up with a knife, and I had to have surgery to repair the damage. So I got out of that marriage at the age of 18. And I feel like that's when I started on the road of being everything I swore I'd never be, doing everything I swore I'd never do, and I hadn't even taken a drink of alcohol yet. I always intuitively knew if I took a drink, I'd be an alcoholic. But it started out with me being a single mother living on welfare. My whole life growing up like that, I swore when I grew up I wouldn't live like that, and there I was. Now on page 23 in the big book, it says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So we're talking about the main problem being the mental obsession and not the physical allergy. So I know for me, I practiced my disease of alcoholism way before I ever took that first drink because I have always had the mental obsession part of this disease. And I practiced it in the form of compulsive overeating. I would shove food in my mouth instead of alcohol, and then I discovered that wonderful world of diet pills, and that's back in the days when doctors gave these really, really good amphetamines, methadrine, dexedrine. It's illegal now. So I went on a diet for 16 years. When I finally took that drink at the age of 25, I immediately had the physical allergy from that very first drink. I had the phenomenon of craving. From that very first drink, I had a personality change. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you read about that in the Big Book, and the Big Book refers to that as a real alcoholic. And I personally am so physically allergic to alcohol that when I consume alcohol, I break out in a rash, welts, and hives all over my body. And I was always too drunk to have a clue that that wasn't normal. And if I'd had a clue, it wouldn't have made a difference. But from that very first drink, I drank morning, noon, and night. And I did not draw a sober breath from the age of 25 to the age of 31. And that is not an exaggeration. I had a huge spiritual experience way before I ever got to this program. And this was equivalent to the one that Bill had in Bill's story. Now, in the Big Book, it says, as a result of a spiritual awakening, you'll have a change in psyche, a change in attitude. It says you'll have a huge emotional displacement rearrangement. And this spiritual experience I had was not enough for me to achieve that. And I believe it's because I did not have a plan of action to go with it. But it was enough for me to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So what I did with this experience is I went to this church, I counseled with this minister, I shared with him about my spiritual experience, I told him all my character defects and all my shortcomings, and this man assured me if I got really active in this church and I read all these inspirational books and I did all this positive thinking and all these affirmations that I could be everything that I ever wanted to be. And after I got to this program, I heard a speaker say, if you're alcoholic, you cannot think your way into right actions. He said, if you're alcoholic, you have to act your way into right thinking. And I am absolute proof of that because I got really active in that church. I even became secretary of that church, and I struggled reading those books because I could barely read. I did all that positive thinking, constant affirmations, and the only thing that resulted was I ended up having a torrid affair with this minister, and it absolutely infuriated his wife. And the rest of the congregation wasn't too thrilled about it either. But the one thing I'm going to share with you now is the one thing I thought I'd take to the grave with me. As secretary of that church, it was my job to handle the money. And when I handled that money, I stole part of that money. Now, at this point in my life, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt my only hope was God, because I had just had a spiritual experience. And I turned to God for help. And I ended up seducing his minister and ripping off his church. So I truly know the feeling of hopelessness that they talk about in the Big Book. I'm going to share two stories with you while I'm on the subject of the minister. And I like to share this first story because it's the first time I was ever able to laugh at any part of my alcoholism. When I first got to this program, I heard that laughter was healing. But I always thought my story was just much too serious. And when I got here, I used to hang out at the very back of the room. And I have a friend named Teddy, and Teddy calls the back of the room the half measure section or the denial section. Now, I didn't hang out back there for either of those reasons. I hung out back there because I couldn't read very well. And I was terrified that somebody would ask me to come up here and read something. So I'd always hide it out at the back of the room, and speakers would get up here and share their stuff, and everybody would laugh. And at first, I was absolutely incapable of laughing. But one day, after I had some sobriety under my belt, I caught myself back there laughing too. But right after having this big belly laugh, I found myself thinking, well, that might be funny for you, but there is nothing, absolutely nothing in my background that I could ever laugh at. And about 4 years ago, I was speaking at a meeting in Seal Beach, and it was just my second time to ever give a talk. And my daughter wanted to come hear me. Now, my daughter got to this program for the first time when she was 15 years old. Today, she's 30, and she did not have continuous sobriety, but today she has 3.5 years. And she goes to school, she wants to be a nurse, and she does hairdressing on the side, and she just works a wonderful AA program. I'm very proud of her, except she's always throwing the Big Book in my face, and that makes me mad. But anyway, at that time, she's trying to get sober again, so she wanted to come to the meeting and hear me talk. But before the meeting, she brought some of her program girlfriends over to the house. We sat down and we had coffee. And then she proceeded to tell these girls my drunkalogue, and it's just the first time I was ever able to laugh at anything. For some reason, it was a little funnier coming out of her mouth than out of my head. But of course, she's telling these girls all about the minister. And I just never, ever thought about how some of this stuff looks through the eyes of a little 9-year-old. And she's telling these girls that I'm dragging her off to church every day. She's learning things like the Ten Commandments, the Golden Rule. I'm constantly preaching all this religious stuff to her. She comes home from school at 3:00 in the afternoon. She opens the bedroom door, and there, naked in bed with her mom, was the married minister of the church. Now, when she first said this, I just felt all this shame, all this guilt, and all this embarrassment. And I just looked at her, and I said, God, honey, that must have been a terrible shock. And she just looked at me, and she said, no, Mom, I don't know what shocked me the most, seeing that minister naked or seeing his artificial leg on the floor. Up until that time, I forgot he had this artificial leg. This is a big leg. I don't know how I forgot it. But trust me, this man in no way was disabled. After I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I started working those 12 steps, I found for me the most important step was step 9. Now, step 9 is the amend step, the step where we make restitution. And I recommend you do the first 8 steps before you get to step 9. I know some people come into this program, they take a look at step 9, it's so scary, they turn around and they leave. Other people come in and start right in on step 9 and make inappropriate amends. I believe the steps are in order for a reason, and I believe this one in particular should be taken with the advice of a sponsor, but I call step 9 the freedom step. This is the step that truly freed me from the bondage of my past, and it's just not a coincidence that in the big book, the promises come after step 9, and it says before you're halfway through, you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. It says you won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, and so on and so on. And I did not have to wait to get halfway through step 9. That happened to me with my very first amends, and that was going back to that church and telling that minister I used to steal from the church funds. And he told me he knew that, and we set up a payment schedule to pay back the church. And then I had to tell him that I used to steal out of his wallet when he was in the shower, and he told me he did not know that. So I made restitution to him. But the neat thing about this whole experience is he shared with me at that time he knew exactly what I was doing. By the time I got to him, he had 2 years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When he lost his leg in that motorcycle accident, he was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he actually died on the operating table. He had one of those near-death experiences, which for him was his spiritual experience. And that's what led him into ministerial school and becoming a minister. And even he could not get sober in church. And I'm not putting down churches, and I'm not putting down the psychiatric effort, because the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous makes it real clear that this program owes a lot to both of these institutions. And in the big book, it says if you need professional help, do not hesitate to seek it. But I got to tell you, for me, it was all about that miracle that happens when one drunk reaches out to another drunk. I'm going to share a story with you that I've started sharing. I've always stressed what it says in the big book about do not hesitate to seek outside help. But there was a time when I first started speaking. You know, the experience I had with the psychiatric effort was not a good experience. And so I was one of those speakers in the very beginning that would get up here and share with you and talk to you and put down the psychiatric effort. And I had an old timer, in fact, it was at the Seal Beach meeting, and I had this old timer who had 30 some odd years, and he came up to me and he said, Michael, I want you to read something in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he took me into this little room and he opened it up to page 133. And what it says there is, it says, God has abundantly supplied this world with many fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. It says, do not hesitate to take your health problems to such individuals. Usually I'll read it out of the book, but I didn't bring my book up here with me. But the one sentence says that we should never, ever belittle a good psychiatrist. And so at that point, I started changing my talk because the big book has never, ever steered me wrong. And so I just started including that in my talk, that we shouldn't hesitate to seek outside help. And thank God he came into my life when he did, because shortly after that, a woman who I'd been sponsoring for several years started to develop mental illness. And I would say she had grave emotional and mental disorders, and it was pretty serious, and she was not about to seek outside help. She heard people at the podium put down the psychiatric effort. She heard people at the podium put down psychiatric drugs or antidepressants or whatever, and she just wasn't about to seek outside help. So finally what happened, and she worked her steps, she really did, and when she was working with others, she was fine, but by the time she went home, and she started, spending time alone. Anytime she spent time alone, weird things started happening to her. She started hearing voices, and she talked about a black thing that would close in on her, and it was pretty scary. And so finally one day she tried to commit suicide, and she was in a coma for 3 days. And because of this suicide attempt, the state forced her into seeking outside help. She had to go see a psychiatrist. And she came over to my house one day, and she was very distraught because this psychiatrist was trying to put her on medication. And the only thing I could say to her was, I just pulled down the big book, and I read to her page 133, that we shouldn't hesitate to seek outside help. And she still chose, because she said, she told me that she knew people in AA would not consider her sober if she went on medication. And within a year, she succeeded in her suicide attempt, and today she's dead. And I feel very bad about that. And I know for me, I always want to remember tradition 10 says that we don't have any opinions on outside issues. And to me, this is an outside issue. Anyway, so when I was 27, I was full on into my drinking. I'm living in an apartment I've been evicted from. That's my normal MO. I'm always being evicted. Lights, gas, and telephone had all... No, I still had a telephone. Lights and gas had been turned on a long time. Turned off for a long time. I had a telephone because it was one of my priorities. And I got this call at 11 o'clock at night, and I could not believe the man on the other end of this phone. It was my real dad. Now, I barely knew this man's name was on my birth certificate, and he wanted to make amends for not being in my life. And he wanted to get to know me, and he wanted to get to know my daughter. So he offered me an opportunity to move to Colorado to get to know his whole family, and I did not want to go. I didn't have any desire to get to know him. But mostly, I did not want to move to the snow. But at that point in my life, I didn't have any place to go except for out on the streets. But deep down inside, I had this little teeny hope, if I did this geographic, maybe I could change. So I made that move to Colorado, and I lived there for 3 months. And in that three-month period, this man and his family could not wait to kick me out of the state of Colorado. In that three-month period, I ended up having affairs with the bus drivers on the way over there, getting pregnant, having abortions, falling down the stairs and breaking my leg, ripping off his medicine cabinet, ripping off his booze cabinet, ripping off his money. So they literally kicked me out of the state of Colorado. I'm going to tell you how I broke that leg. Obviously, I was drunk. And in the neighborhood where I live, the liquor stores closed at 12. And I had to make my final liquor run before the stores closed. And it's snowing outside. The stairs are very icy. And I lived in a second floor apartment. And I'm walking down the stairs, hanging onto the railing with my right hand. And my daughter's on the left side of me trying to hold me up. And all of a sudden, I looked up at another second floor apartment because the door had just opened. And out of that door walked a priest. I don't know what he was doing there, but he had the collar, the robe, everything. He is definitely a man of God. And I am very angry at God. I'm angry at God because I just seduced his minister and ripped off his church. So now I'm mad at God. And so I looked up at that priest. I let go of the railing with my right hand. I flipped up my middle finger, and I said, F you, God. And I immediately fell down the stairs and broke my leg. Now, my daughter tells me that's the day she started believing in a punishing God. And today we both know it's because I was drunk. But anyway, my real dad was second on my list of amends to make when I started making my amends. And I wrote this man a letter, and I told him that I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to make restitution for my behavior up there. And I sent him a check trying to set up a payment schedule to pay him back. And basically what he and the family did is they sent me the check back with a little note that said they didn't want my money and they never wanted to hear from me again. I was working with a sponsor, so of course I'd stay sober. But I really did want to make these amends. So on every Father's Day and on every birthday, I would send him a card. And I would tell him that I was still sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I still wanted to make restitution for my behavior up there. And he would never, ever acknowledge me. And I did this for several years. And finally, in 1985 or 1986, I got a reply back. And I just cannot tell you how excited I was when I saw the return address on that envelope. And I ripped open the envelope, and the only thing that was in it was a picture of his tombstone and the obituary out of the newspaper. He had just died. And that was the family's way of telling me not to bother trying anymore. And there are no words to express the kind of pain I felt. You would have thought I knew my whole life, and I didn't, but I took it real, real hard. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous pointed out to me that I don't make amends for approval. The Big Book tells me I don't make amends to be forgiven. I make amends to clean up my side of the street. I make amends to stay sober. So all I can tell you is that the actions I took worked, because not once, not even once, was I ever tempted to drink over that rejection. I'm so sorry he didn't get to know the person I am today, because I know he would have been proud. So anyway, I've been kicked out of this church, and now I'm kicked out of a state. I'm living back in Long Beach, California, across the street from Franklin Junior High. Franklin Junior High is a gang-related school. My daughter's now 14 years old, and she's running with a very dangerous gang. And I'm doing awful, humiliating, embarrassing things to my daughter. But I'm not only embarrassing my daughter, I'm embarrassing this entire gang. I was living in another apartment. This is really true, too. I was living in another apartment I was being evicted from. Lights, gas, and telephone had all been turned off for a long time, and I was hiding out from the landlord. So I always kept my drapes closed, and my apartment's dark. My apartment is so dark that now I'm seeing evil spirits. And unless you've seen them, they're hard to describe. But these evil spirits would do things to me, like follow me around the house. And then I, in turn, would do things like crawl out of the house on my hands and knees, butt naked, across the street to the school ground and warn my daughter and her gang friends not to come home. The house is possessed with evil spirits. And this is the kind of stuff I did that makes me wish to God I was a blackout drinker. But I'm not. I'm not. I get to remember it all. All the neighbors felt sorry for my daughter. They would hide her out sometimes, and sometimes they would feed her. Sometimes they would even feed me. Once we were both next door at the neighbor's house, she was feeding both of us. And on her counter, she had a bottle of 100-proof vodka. Something happened outside, a car accident or something, and my neighbor and my daughter went to check it out. And I just wanted to drink some of that vodka down real fast and not get caught. So I just grabbed the bottle, which was not unusual, and I started drinking right out of the bottle. And I don't know how much I drank or how fast I drank it, but I do know it was enough to stop my respiratory system. At that point, I stopped breathing. And I can remember the sensation I couldn't breathe. It's the last thing I remember. I don't remember the paramedics. I don't remember being rushed to the hospital. I don't remember being resuscitated. By the time I had any memory, I woke up strapped down to a hospital bed with a nurse slapping me in the face because I was screaming obscenities at her because I was a very mean and vile drunk. But this experience did get my attention. This time I had almost died under the influence of alcohol, and it scared me. I did not want to die out there, so I finally started listening to my daughter. My daughter used to tell me on a daily basis, she would say, "Mom, it's the alcohol, and if you wouldn't drink, you wouldn't do those things." She said, "Just smoke pot." So this is my only experience smoking pot, but I was trying really hard not to drink that day. I don't have any friends of my own, so I smoked this pot with my daughter and her friends. And afterwards, we're walking down the street, and I have on these tight, tight jeans, and I have both my hands in my pockets. And I don't know if I tripped over a crack or tripped over my own foot, but I tripped, and I just started to go down. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been on pot, but for me, it was different. First of all, I had the feeling that I was in slow motion. I had the sensation that the cement was coming up at my face. And no matter what I did, and I tried really hard, I could not get my hands out of my pocket. So you got to picture a grown woman laying there with her face smashed in cement, her hands are still in her pockets, and everybody standing around me was laughing hysterically. They were absolutely hysterical. And I really hurt myself, you know, and I'm laying there in a lot of pain, and I could hear everybody laughing. And as I heard that laughter, I had that moment of clarity. Right then and there, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that pot was not the answer. And I went right back to my drinking. And I drank at the same pace for a while longer. And I don't know what finally happened, but I finally reached a point you hear about in this program where I was just sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I woke up one morning on my front room floor and I was laying in a puddle of fluid. I don't know what the fluid was, but I took the first three steps, and I didn't know what the first three steps were. But I knew that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had never, ever been manageable, and I already believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I just didn't know if he would because of what I had done to the church. And this was my way and my way of turning my will and my life over to the care of God, as I just got on my knees and I just said, God, please, I don't care how you do it, but please just get me sober. And I managed to get to a telephone. I called a prayer line affiliated with the church I was in, and I asked them to pray for me. Because in my mind, I thought if God would not listen to my prayers because of what I'd done to the church, maybe God would listen to their prayers. And they prayed for me for 30 days, and within 30 days, I was sober. And it's a series of God coincidences that landed me in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm not going to share about those tonight. But I will let you know that I was so physically sick from withdrawals, there's no way I would have made that first drink without a beer, and I ended up having two beers before the meeting, and that's the last drink I ever had, and that was on November 10th, 1979. But I don't celebrate my birthday till 3 months later in January 23rd, 1980, because when I got here, first of all, I'll tell you that old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous are the ones that got me sober. They just latched on to me, and most of them were men. And thank God for these men, because they changed my attitude about men, because the way I was raised, I didn't have a very good opinion of men, and they changed my opinion of men. And there was absolutely no worry about 13th stepping. First of all, I was very huge and obese. I had this wild, wild bleached blonde hair that broke off. It was all broken because I'd be drunk when I bleached my hair. So it was kind of punky style, which would be in style today, right? Big black roots, and my teeth were worn up to here. They were all not up yet, so when I smiled, it looked like I had no teeth. And I always wore a big serape to hide my body, and I was profusely sweating all the time. So no worry about 13th stepping. They just wanted me to get sober. So it's funny how God works, isn't it? But anyway, we had this one old-timer, and if you mentioned the word drugs, he would jump up, cuss you out, tell you to go to NA, and then he would split. So I learned early on in my sobriety to keep my mouth shut about those diet pills. But what that did for me is that allowed me to take diet pills for 3 more months. But when I quit drinking, I started working my steps. And at least for me, God revealed to me right away I wasn't sober if I was. So I gave this up January 23rd, 1980. I go into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and now I've got 3 beers in my system. And 2 beers in my system. Okay, I admit I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not an alcoholic like you guys, because you guys are alcoholics like my mom. It's a disease of perception, but it worked for me. And the first person shared that he'd been a blackout drinker. And I looked at my 14-year-old daughter who desperately wanted me to get sober. I said, I have never had a blackout. And then the next person shared that he'd been to jail. And I looked at my daughter and I said, and I have never been to jail. The truth is, I was a home drinker. I was always too drunk to get out of my house to go get arrested. And when I managed to crawl out on my hands and knees, one of the gang members would capture me and put me to bed. But the third person shared that he had five 502s. Now, back then, a drunk driving, back then in California, 502 was a drunk driving. I used to be embarrassed to share this, but I'm not anymore. Word for word, I said to my daughter, and I was so defiant just like this, I said, that does it. I have never, ever had a 502. And this time, my daughter looked at me with all the hate, all the contempt a little Al-Anon could have in her eyes, and word for word, she said, Mom, you don't even have a car. But when she said that, something clicked for me. At that point, I knew I was just sitting there looking for the differences. So if any of you are new or nearly new, I hope that you're not trying to judge your alcoholism by my actions or any other speaker's actions. And I know that I have a story that's hard to identify with, but maybe you can identify with the feelings. Maybe you've had those feelings of low self-worth, low self-esteem, not equal to, and just not good enough. Maybe you've had those feelings of overwhelming fear, and this is the kind of fear that paralyzes you. It keeps you from going back to school. It keeps you from getting a better job. It did that for me, but it also kept me from getting on elevators, couldn't get on airplanes, couldn't drive over bridges, couldn't get on freeways. I literally could not leave the city of Long Beach. It made my world real, real small. I used to have severe panic attacks behind my fear in sobriety. Or maybe you're like that alcoholic in the Big Book, just grandiose and better than. To me, it's all the same for an alcoholic. It's just that my ego was in reverse. But the next person that shared was my point of identification. And I believe if she hadn't been in that meeting that night, I might not be standing here tonight because of my attitude. But she said that she didn't drink till later on in life. She said she practiced her disease of alcoholism way before she ever took that first drink. And she did it in the form of compulsive overeating and amphetamine abuse. And that's when that old timer jumped up and cussed her out. But the one thing she said, and this is the real reason why I stayed, she said her whole life growing up, some kids wanted to be doctors and some kids wanted to be lawyers. And all she ever wanted to do when she grew up was just not to be an alcoholic like her mom. And when she said that, I just started to cry and I couldn't stop. And I cried throughout the rest of the meeting because that's absolutely the first time in my life that I ever felt like I belonged. And I'm supposed to share with you what it was like, what happened to change me, and what I'm like today. And what happened to change me were those 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I always talk about the steps. I always try to keep within the fifth tradition. And because my talk, you know, longer you're sober, the longer your talk gets. So I try to shorten the steps a little bit. So I will just let you know that I did those first three steps in a formal manner out of the Big Book. And I did, and we got on our knees, my sponsor and I got on our knees and said the third step prayer. And I did the inventory according to the Big Books, the three inventories, one on resentment, one on fear, and one on sex. And it was very important that we added that fourth column looking at my part. And she also said that I had to list everything I felt guilty about because this was my inventory. And when I did step five, I did 5, 6, 7, and 8 all at one time. My sponsor did not trust me to go home and contemplate on my own character defects. She thought it was her job to point them out to me, and it's a good thing she did because I truly would have missed this one. She told me at the very top of my list I had self-pity. And I told her in the most pathetic way that I thought my self-pity was justified. Look at my childhood. And she told me in the most loving way, she said, Michael, alcoholics cannot afford justified self-pity. And she gave me that old cliche, poor me. Pour me, pour me another drink. We got on our knees and we said that seventh step prayer. And I can honestly tell you that self-pity's been totally removed and it's been replaced with overwhelming gratitude. On step 8, she had me do it in 3 columns. First column was short-term amends that I could do within 6 months. Second column was long-term amends that eventually took me 12 years because I had a lot of financial wreckage out there. And third column is we worked out ways and means of making restitution to institutions I couldn't get hold of or maybe people who were deceased. And on step 9, she assured me it didn't matter how long it took me to do step 9, as long as I was willing and doing whatever I could. But she said, most importantly, while doing step 9, I still had to live in 10, 11, and 12. And I love Chuck C. Chuck C. says this program is about uncovering, discovering, and discarding. And to me, step 9 is the discard step. I know there's a lot of good psychiatrists out there today, a lot of good psychologists. A lot of them are in 12-step programs. But I have to tell you that that was not my experience. I went to a psychiatrist and a psychologist way before I ever got here. We spent a very long time in uncover and discover, never once got on with discarding, and what that did for me is that allowed me to stay in that victim role for a very long time. And I don't even know how this step works. All I know is in the big book it tells me that I have to disregard the other man's faults entirely. So when I made amends to my dad, I never once said, but you were an older married man, you got my teenage mom pregnant, and you abandoned us. I never once said that to him. I just made amends to him for what I had done, and for some reason, my resentment towards him went away. And I don't know how that works. I don't have to know how it works. I just have to know that it does. My sponsor taught me to do a spot check inventory for my 10th step. Immediately, if I know I'm in the wrong, I do 4 through 9 on it. But she believes inventories, even a 10-step inventory, as in a business, should be done in writing. And so she has me cast the balance sheet at the end of the evening before I go to bed. And this balance sheet is in the 12 and 12 under step 10, but it falls right in line with step 10 and step 11 upon retiring at night in the big book. And on this balance sheet, on one side, she has me list all my liabilities for the day. That's all the character defects I got into, any amends I might have to make, anything I might have to run past my sponsor. And on the other side, I list all my assets for the day. And assets is everything I did right that day. She says, because I come from such low self-esteem, it's important that I'm aware of the things that I'm doing right. And I always have more assets than I do liabilities. I get to look at myself in a whole new light today. On the 11th step, I do my form of prayer and meditation in the morning. Now that I'm married, my husband and I get on our knees together and we say the 3rd step prayer, the 7th step prayer. We pray for God to direct our thinking. We pray to be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking motives. We pray to know God's will and the power to carry that out. And then on my own, I do a form of meditation where I try to listen to God. And not once in that meditation has God ever come down and told me anything. But as a result of that meditation, I intuitively know how to handle situations throughout the day that used to baffle me. And I have had profound spiritual experiences at unexpected times. You know, I love Dick Martin. He says the most spiritual you can get in this program is reaching your hand out to a newcomer. And I believe that's true because, you know, on page 14 and 15 in the big book, it says an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life except through work and self-sacrifice for others. So basically it says if you're not working with others, you fail to grow spiritually. Step 12, my sponsor really did stress the 12th step. And she broke it into 3 parts for me. That first part, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of doing those first 11 steps, she said did not necessarily mean a belief in God. She said a lot of us believe in God when we get here. Some people come in here and they have to make the 12 steps their higher power, or they have to make the group their higher power. She said when you've had that spiritual awakening is where you've actually had that huge emotional displacement and rearrangement. You've had that change in psyche. You have had that change in attitude. Something about you's just different. You've had a transformation and it comes from deep within. And when it comes to carrying the message, If I have 15 days of sobriety, I give my phone number to someone who has 7. And she said length of time was not the requirement for sponsorship in this program. She said the requirement for sponsorship in this program is that you have done your steps, because the real job of a sponsor is to guide you through the steps of the program. And I had 2 men that were really instrumental in my sobriety, and that was a Bill and a Frank Honeycutt. And I'm not breaking their anonymity. That's how they like to be identified. And Bill's now deceased, but I guess at this period of time, I'd completed step 8, but I wasn't really into step 9. And Frank used to always ask me how I was doing. And I'd always say, squirrely. I just feel so squirrely. And my sponsor told me I had to stop using the word squirrely. And then I'd tell Frank things like, well, I guess I got to do some more writing. I got to work on myself some more. And Frank said, for God's sakes, Michael, don't study yourself. He said, what you have to do is get out of yourself and go work with another alcoholic. And I get to experience today what Frank used to experience with me, because, you know, I know a lot of people who come into this program, they say they get a huge spiritual release with 4 and 5, and that just wasn't the case for me. I didn't get any relief in this program until I started on step 9. I'll just let some of you know who can't figure out what's wrong if you've done 4 and 5 and you didn't get that release. But anyway, and so I was real squirrely because I'd just done 8. But I get to experience today what Frank used to experience with me, because I sponsor a lot of women in this program, and I sponsor some women that I call whiners. And I can talk about whiners because I used to be a whiner. You know, they just whine about everything. They've got to call you every single day and whine. And, you know, if it's a big deal, I go to the gates of insanity with them. I really do. But if it's that everyday whining, I'll just do to them what Frank used to do to me. And I'll always try and bring them back to the steps. And I'll always say, are you working with any other alcoholics? And this is the normal reply. Well, nobody ever asks me. Well, if all you do is whine in a meeting, nobody even knows that you've done your steps. But what Frank says, what Frank used to say to me, he used to say, nobody ever asks you. You just go to a meeting and you watch for the newcomers that stand up with less than 30 days. In California, you have to stand up for your first 30 days of sobriety. He said, you go up to one and you say, do you have a sponsor? And if they say no, you say, I'm it. They're brand new. They don't know they have a choice. So I'm here tonight to tell you that that does work. I've had to do a lot of it since I moved to Georgia. Another thing I do is when I go up to a newcomer and I get their phone, I give them my phone number, I always get their phone number because it's hard for newcomers to call. And if I'm in a bad place, I call a newcomer. Don't know if it helps a newcomer, but I know it helps me. Applying these principles in all my affairs, that means I have to practice love and service at work. I have to practice love and service at home. I can't come into this program, walk that walk, talk that talk, and then go out in the world and act like a jerk. And my sponsor knew a lot about Bill W. And she told me right from the start, excuse me, that Bill did not like to use the same word twice, that character defects and shortcomings are the same thing. They're both the exact nature of your wrongs in step 5 that we get from step 4, and that principles and steps are the same thing. You know, I just heard the speaker the other day get up there and say, principles are not the steps of the program. And he gave you all these things like the principles are honesty, da 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 da. And that was, and that makes sense, because if you're working a 12-step program, all those attributes are spiritual principles. But I went back to the big book and I reread and I reread and I reread, and it says, it's saying the principles are the steps. The principles we have set down, it said. So I know when that was written, that's what it meant. And I went to the 12 and 12 under step 10, and it did give you a lot of spiritual principles. But when the big book was written, it refers to the steps. So I hate that when other speakers get my mind going and I have to go read them. I have to go study everything. So, but anyway, so applying these principles in all my affairs, and now I forgot where I was at, but principles are steps. And so she says, if I'm applying these principles in all my affairs, I'm applying these steps in all my affairs. And she said, if I was willing to grow along spiritual lines and I had to stay current in my steps, eventually, someday, God would reveal to me when it's time to give up other destructive behavior. The Big Book says that we have to get rid of all those old ideas. And she said, it was not okay for me to just not drink, but to go ahead and steal. It's not okay for me to just not drink, but to prostitute. It's not okay for me to just not drink, but to abuse my daughter. And it's not okay for me to just not drink, but to binge my brains out and take diet pills. She said if I was working the last part of the 12th step in Alcoholics Anonymous, those things were not okay. And thank God she told me I didn't have to do it all at one time, or I surely would have failed, because all those things I just mentioned were listed on my step 6, my character defects, and I don't practice any of them today. Now I have a brand new character defect. Today I'm judgmental and opinionated. But I'm telling you, I pay a heavy price for that one, because what happens to me when I'm judgmental and opinionated, I wind up walking in their shoes, experience their experience, to get over that judgment. So when I catch myself being judgmental, I just pray I can find another way to get over it. Anyway, so I have 6 months of sobriety. I'm on my 9th step. And my sponsor told me I had to get a job. I had to be fully self-supporting through my own contributions. And I don't know how to work. And I went out there and I got my first job, and that's where I learned how to work. I learned things like how to get there every day, how to get there on time, how to not leave early, how to only take a 30-minute lunch break. I did not know how to do those things, and I learned them here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked my first job full-time for 8 years. I stayed on another 2 years part-time after I took another full-time position. So I was there for a total of 10 years. When I left that job, I worked myself up to assistant administrator. And in that first 8-year period, I went back to high school. And I graduated from high school in 1985, and I was 36 years old. And I graduated with a cap, a gown, a real ceremony, and 450 18-year-olds. And all these... thank you. I'm just now getting where I can talk about it and not cry up here. But all these kids were so bad, they were kicked out of day school, so they had to go to night school, but I just fit right in with them. What I did for the next 6 years is I went to work for the musical theater industry, and I was not qualified for that position that I applied for. It was just starting out at the bottom in the accounting department. But for some reason, they were willing to take a chance on me, so I had to be willing to take a chance on them, because it was scary for me to leave my other job. My self-esteem was there. But I took that position, and I went back to school. And within a period of time, I worked myself up to business manager of this multi-million-dollar corporation. And this is an equity corporation, which means it deals with big major stars. And as business manager, I dealt with millions of dollars. And when I got to this program, I didn't even know how many zeros were in $1 million. And I participated in union negotiations, and I've been invited into some of the homes of some of the most famous people you see on stage, screen, and TV. And sometimes, even today, I'll see myself in a picture with a very famous person, and I just get overwhelmed. And I just think, how did I ever get from the gutters of Long Beach to being invited to some of these places? And how that happened is I worked the last part of that 12th step, and I applied these principles in all my affairs. I'm going to share with you about a party I went to right after I became business manager. It was a birthday party for Debbie Reynolds. Nowadays, everybody's so young, they don't have a clue who Debbie Reynolds is. So they're just not the least bit impressed. But when I was a little girl growing up, Debbie Reynolds was my idol. She's my very favorite movie star. And I was very impressed about being business manager and going to this birthday party for her. And for the first time in my life, everything was perfect, absolutely perfect. And I was 10 years sober, and I almost drank. The Big Book says you'll be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, if you're in fit spiritual condition. I was not in fit spiritual condition. In the first place, I hadn't been to a meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous in over 2 weeks, because I'm just much too busy growing in the business world. I wasn't working with any other alcoholics, because I'm just much too busy growing in the business world. And the Big Book says you don't even grow spiritually unless you're working with others. So I started getting into this stinking thinking, and I started thinking thoughts like, well, maybe now that I have this very impressive job, and I have an education, and I drive a brand new car, and I'm not that little girl from the other side of the tracks, maybe I'm really not an alcoholic. And thank God I didn't act on it that night, because one healthy thing I've done for myself is I do not have anonymity at work. Everybody at work knew I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had enough respect for this program that I did not want to drink in front of my coworkers, so I put it off that night. I was going to drink the next day. And I think anybody who's worked these steps as hard as I had worked these steps, God had a chance to intervene. And the next day I was asked to pay a 12-step call on a makeup artist. This man hadn't shown up at work for 2 weeks. He was held up in a motel, and the motel was trying to get him out. And they called my place of employment and talked to the executive director. And the executive director asked me to go see what I could do. And I got another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a man, and he went with me. And I did not want to go. I was very resentful. And this was a sleazy motel. And I went and I knocked on this man's door. And I identified myself, Michael Alcoholic. And for some reason, he answered the door. If that had been me, I would not have answered the door. But he answered the door. And I stood there speechless. I thought I had the wrong room because I did not recognize him. The man I knew, he's a makeup artist, but he had all this blonde wavy hair and he was just real hunk. The man standing in front of me was bald-headed. He was 10 times his normal size. He was profusely sweating. He was bleeding from head to toe because he kept falling into objects. He smelled of urine, he smelled of alcohol, and he smelled of vomit. And at that point, I had a spiritual experience and I had an inner voice talk to me that said, Michael, this is you. You are not like the people you were with last night. If you drink again, you're standing in front of a mirror. And that man doesn't know it, but he's the one who paid a 12-step call on me. Because that night I got my Fanny into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I recommitted to this program. I go to more meetings than I've ever gone to. I work with more alcoholics than I've ever worked with because I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the longer I'm sober, the more I need meetings. The longer I'm sober, the easier it is for me to forget where I came from. I can't believe how cunning and baffling this disease is. But the best thing about speaking for me is that I constantly get up here and I remind myself where I come from. That's why I always share my drunk log, to remind myself where I come from. I'm going to share a story with you of how I came to the terms with the God I have in my life today. I told you my daughter was 15 years old when she got to this program. When she was 18 years old, she had 3 years of sobriety. She and her girlfriend were leaving an AA dance. They were in the parking lot of the dance. A man came up to him with a gun and forced these two girls in the car at gunpoint, and he kidnapped them. He knocked the one girl unconscious and brutally raped my daughter for over 2 hours. And I hate the word rape because it sounds like it's just about sex, but rape is really about terror, and it's about violence. And the whole time this was going on, my daughter knew he was going to kill her anyway. She was so angry at God. It took her over 2 years to remember that she did say a quiet prayer to live. This man was drinking. He had a bottle of alcohol in his pocket. He drank throughout the whole ordeal. Thank God he got quite drunk. And at the point where he's forcing my daughter into the trunk of the car, somehow my daughter got the courage to at least make some kind of an effort to try to save her own life. She caught him off guard and slugged him in the face as hard as she could. He tripped and he fell down. The gun slid under the wheel and she ran down the street naked and she got away. At that point, he got back into the car and took off with the car with the other girl in the car and eventually stopped and pushed her out into the street so both girls lived. But the road of recovery was real hard and it was real long. My daughter and I felt absolutely betrayed. How could God let this happen to us? We were both sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. How could God let this happen to us? We were both working these steps as hard as we could, and this is a spiritual program. But the hardest thing for me to deal with was a sentence in the Big Book. It used to be one of my favorite pages. It's page 449, and it talks about acceptance. And I still like the part on acceptance, but that one sentence says, Absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. Clancy says alcoholism is a disease of perception. I'm still an alcoholic. I still get my disease of perception because I perceive that to mean that if nothing in God's world happens by mistake, then that had to be an act of God. It had to be an act of God, and I wanted to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to leave God because I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt I didn't want any part of a God that could operate like that. And thank God for this man named Bill Honeycutt, Frank's brother. He just took me by the hand and he said, Michael, God is good, and good is God. And if it's not good, it's not of God. He said, man has free will. That man was acting on his free will, and your daughter was just a victim. He said, if man didn't have free will, we wouldn't all be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd all be perfect people. And when he told me that, I had a spiritual release. And I knew he was telling me the truth. And I love to hear my sponsor, Polly, share. She always talks about finding God deep within. And that's what it says in the Big Book. It says we find God deep within. And on that same page, it says it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. And when I'm into fear and I'm into calamity, I feel disconnected from my higher power. And that's when I so desperately, desperately need the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because if God's deep within me, then God's deep within you. And it's at these times that God will reach out to another member of this program and pull me back into the sunlight of the Spirit. And that's what happened to me through a man named Bill Honeycutt. So I came to terms with my God again. But I still had so much trouble with that sentence in the Big Book. I could hear somebody out in the lobby talk about something wonderful, say that sentence, and I would feel absolute rage. And I sponsor a lot of women in this program. And because of my story, I sponsor a lot of women who have suffered terrible tragedies. And one of these women made the mistake of telling me that her tragedy must be God's will, because in the Big Book it says absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. This woman desperately needed comfort, and I went off on her like a crazy woman. I started screaming at her to the top of my lungs that that wasn't written by the first 100 alcoholic, and it's not in the first 164 pages of the Big Book. I took that Big Book, I slammed it down, I said, that's not even in the first two editions of this book. And I made this woman cry. And I knew at that point that I was the one who had a problem. I have a resentment about something in the Big Book. But this resentment's not only hurting me, now it's hurting other people. And I came to a place of really being willing to give it up. And I prayed for a very long time for God to help me with that sentence. And about 3 years ago, I was with my sponsor, Polly. And she was the speaker in a meeting, and she was sharing about a tape out by Clancy. A lot of people think we're in the Pacific group, and we're not, but we have a lot of respect for the Pacific group. But anyway, the name of this tape is Alcoholism, Disease of Perception. And it's not even an AA tape. Clancy's talking to a group of doctors. But in this meeting, right when Polly said the words, disease of perception, I had the biggest spiritual encounter that I have ever had. I had an inner voice talk to me, and it was loud, and it was clear, and it wasn't through the ears. And I couldn't hear another word Polly said, and I couldn't see anything else in the room. And that voice said, Michael, you know what happens in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as part of God's world. What happens when you're working those 12 steps as part of God's world? The progression of all good is part of God's world. What happened in that car 9 years ago was part of man's world. And when I was able to separate man's world from God's world, I was able to come to terms with that sentence in the Big Book. And I too can stand here right now and tell you absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. That's how I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, 2 weeks after I had this spiritual experience through a real weird series of coincidences, I found myself sitting down at a dinner table having dinner with Dr. Paul, who wrote that sentence in the Big Book. And I was at such peace. I did not have to tell this man all about my resentment. Because I knew at that point it did not matter what he meant when he wrote it. What mattered was how I perceived it. And sometimes I have to work on my perception so that perception can work in my life. And that might not work for you, and that's okay, because I truly believe that God works for each one of us at our own level of understanding. I once heard, if you take one step towards God, God takes 10 steps towards you. And in this lifetime, as we know it, we will never, ever reach God's level of understanding. But once we're on a spiritual path, God does not want to lose one of us. So he comes to each one of us and works for each one of us at our individual level of understanding. And that's why what works for you might not work for me, and what works for me might not work for you. But the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is whatever you believe, it will work within the 12 steps. Now, since that day that man's heard my talk, we've had lots of spiritual talks. We've talked at lots of conventions together. And today I consider this man my spiritual advisor. And what he told me about that sentence is that he did not mean anything like that when he wrote that sentence. He was not thinking of man's inhumanity to man. He said my spiritual experience was the best explanation he could think of as why evil exists in this world. And I am so thankful I paid attention to something I read in the 12 and 12 under step 10. It said restraint of pen and tongue. Because when I found out this man was still alive, I used to think everybody in the big book was dead. When I found out this man was still alive, I cannot tell you how many countless times I sat down and I started to write him a letter and tell him exactly what I thought about him and exactly what I thought about that sentence. And if I'd followed through, I would have missed out on this gift, because today this man is a gift in my life. And he gets lots of letters about that sentence, and he gets lots of phone calls about that sentence. And what he does today, a lot of the time, is he just gives them my phone number. I'm going to share one last story with you, and I'm going to close. I had the privilege, and this is a lot of years ago, but I've had some people ask me why I don't share it anymore because my talk's getting so long. But I had the privilege of taking an atheist through the first three steps. And this man chose me because he knew I tried to recover in church. And he had tried to recover in church. And I really believe women sponsor women and men sponsor men. But this was a different circumstance. And I had a man with 18 years sit in on us. But he tried to recover in every church there was. I mean, if you heard the list, it was ridiculous. We're talking Mormon, Baptist, Hindu, Buddhist, Catholic. I mean, the list goes an infinitum. And he could not recover. So he came to the opinion that there was no God. And he did not want to hear a word about God. But for some reason, he really did believe in the steps. And he pestered me, and he pestered me, and he pestered me. And I just didn't know how I was going to do this because I believed in God. And finally, one day, I just remembered the third tradition, that the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. It doesn't say that you have to believe in God. So I became willing to take him through those steps, and the only way I knew how to do it is out of the big book. So we got into the big book, and every other word is God, 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 God. And so I got to a place that I was changing the word God. I changed the word God for 12 steps, Alcoholics Anonymous, the group, whatever I could fit in, I changed the word God. And we got through all the reading. When we got to the first, taking the first step, we had absolutely no problem taking the first step. And by changing the words, we struggled and got to the second step. But the third step was almost impossible. And we talked and we talked, and I gave it my best shot. And this man with me gave it his best shot. And this man just did not know how he was going to turn his will and his life over the care of anything. And I would say things to him like, can you turn your will and your life over to the care of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous? This is a group of people who have stayed sober, so it's got to be a power greater than you. And he said, they're just people. Why would I do that? And then I said, well, can you turn your will and your life over to the care of the 12 steps? You really believe in the 12 steps. And he thought about that, and he said, maybe someday, but right now it didn't make sense to him. And I was pretty frustrated, and you could see he had all this anguish on his face, and I just wanted to call it quits. And just out of nowhere, I remembered this man named Bill Honeycutt. I said, there's this man, and he says that God is good, and good is God. Can you turn your will and your life over to the care of good? And it was just like a light went on in his eyes, and tears started streaming down his face. And what he told me is that he thought about the feeling he feels when he's in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, which he always called a spirit of good. And for some reason, he said that made sense. He could turn his will and his life over to this spirit of good. And this man named Sandy, standing with me, he just jumped up and he said, well, that works for me. And so I said, well, I guess it works for me. And we got on our knees by changing the words, and we said the third step prayer. And afterwards, when we got up, this man gave me the biggest bear hug I have ever had. And he cried and he sobbed. And he said he was so afraid he couldn't have this program because he didn't believe in God. And at that point, I knew that this was right. I knew that this was good. I knew that this was God's will. And I knew this man still considered himself an atheist, but I was right in the middle of a spiritual experience. And my God is so good, so pure, and so perfect. My God does not have an ego and does not need to take the credit. My God only cares that someone's willing to change their life by applying these principles in all their affairs. I want to thank you for allowing me to be here. I know today I've been catapulted into what Bill calls that fourth dimension of existence, because today I know happiness and peace, but best of all, and I mean absolutely best of all, today I know usefulness. Thanks.